Fighting battles are full of critical moments, and they can become our greatest guides. But choosing the right answers and not the easy answers is one of the greatest challenges. Therefore, check out this riveting episode with retired Air Force Colonel Dan Manning and discover how he went from leading and solving challenges in the air war against ISIS to solving your greatest challenges with powerful storytelling. Welcome to the Forged by Trust podcast. I'm your host, Robin Dreek, professional speaker, executive coach, former U.S. Marine, spy recruiter, best-selling author, and your trust and communication expert. Coming up next on the Forged by Trust podcast.
Humans speak different languages. They have different experiences, but we're not too different. Every story worth telling and every story worth hearing is a story of transformation. It's always a story of change. And if you center your story around that change, it's going to be more effective. It's asking questions, making connections, and helping to sort of pull out those pieces that you need to be able to write.
Welcome to the show. I'm Robin Dreek, and on the Forged by Trust podcast, we decode the interpersonal communication skills of the world's most acclaimed forgers of trust. We unlock the skills and techniques from spies, spy recruiters, master interrogators, globally recognized behavioral experts, C-suite executives, entrepreneurs, acclaimed authors, and thought leaders. Each episode provides specific actions that you can immediately apply to any aspect of your personal or professional life. Today's episode, Guided by Critical Moments, is with my good friend Dan Manning. Dan is a retired Air Force colonel, story specialist, and expert in critical thinking, collaboration, creativity, and communication. With over two decades of experience in the military, Dan has flown fighter aircraft, negotiated with the Russian military, and worked as a speechwriter for senior officials in the U.S. Air Force. Dan's passion for storytelling and his expertise in problem-solving have led him to help businesses build stories that hold attention long enough to get to yes. He's committed to teaching critical thinking, collaboration, creativity, and communication to teams who solve tough problems. During the episode today, we talk about leading air operations in the fight against ISIS, focusing on pivotal moments, learning from others through storytelling, going for the right answers, not the easy answers, and how to counter our decision-making biases. Dan, it is such an honor and a pleasure to have a really phenomenal hero. When I heard through you telling me that you did a career as an A-10 pilot, I just got goosebumps right off the bat anyway, because who does not love that air platform? But the striking thing to me, so anyway, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you. Thanks. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Look at me just trying to dive right in because I'm really excited about having you here. So this is the most interesting thread I've seen in someone. So here you are. You've done 25 years as an Air Force officer, an A-10 pilot. Thank you for your service. But you are this amazing, majestic storyteller that basically helps people solve problems, forge trust, innovate all these things through storytelling. That's an unusual thread. What started that? Where did it all begin?
Yeah, So if you know anything about fighter pilots, you know that fighter pilots tell stories. In fact, when I was going through pilot training and then I stayed afterwards to teach the brand new pilots how to fly, and then eventually went to the A-10.
Okay, so we're going to go back further in time, Dan. I am a horrible host. I hear things. I want to go back further.
Okay.
What inspired you to want to be a pilot?
All right. So honestly, so I had an uncle who was a weapon system operator, so a backseater, and he flew in F-4s for a while, and then in F-15Es. And then as I was growing up, you know, I'd hear about him, and of course he didn't live nearby because there were no Air Force bases around Alabama, or at least in Birmingham, Alabama, where I was living.
And that's where you grew up, and you grew up in Birmingham, Alabama?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, that's where I'm coming to you now from, just outside of Birmingham. But I would, you know, hear stories about him and just sort of his flying career and what he was doing. So it always seemed like something that was pretty, it would be a cool thing to do. And I liked, you know, going to the airport. My grandfather would take me out. We'd watch airplanes coming into land. And whenever one was flying over, that was like the one my uncle was flying, he would say, oh, that's the plane that Mike flies. So I sort of from a young age started having this appreciation for flying and for aviation and for military aviation. But it wasn't until I was in college and it looked like I had through ROTC and it looked like I had the chance maybe to go fly.
And what did you go to college for? What did you want to do? Like when you were that age and you're seeing these things up in the air and you have these inspirational people around you, any sense of the path you wanted to walk back then?
Yeah. So back then I just wanted to go to college. So my family didn't have like a college fund or anything set aside. So if I was going to go to college, I needed to figure out how I was going to do that. And the Air Force offered me the opportunity to do that through some, through scholarships. My major was in computer science. I was good with computers and it was something that I could do. At the time though, I was probably more interested in something like international relations, but there were no scholarships for international relations, but there were for computer science. So great, I'll do that. Nice. And then along the way, I did pretty well and I had the chance to go fly. And really my attitude then was, if I have the opportunity to do it, why would I not do it?
How did you have the chance to go fly? It takes a huge amount of effort, self-discipline, resilience, tenacity, as well as opportunity. Opportunity is created through relationships. I mean, so here you are in college, you're majoring in computer science and you just happen to have an opportunity to fly. How did that happen?
Well, I mean, I was pretty good at ROTC, right? I was good at
and you did Air Force ROTC?
Yeah, Air Force ROTC. And you know, my grades were good. I performed well at all the military things that I was asked to perform well at doing. And some people there sort of sponsored me and said, here's the kind of person that we want to go fly. It was right at the time that I got selected for pilot training. It was among the smallest group of pilots that the Air Force had trained since maybe the Air Force started training pilots. It was right in the middle of this drawdown.
And what year was that around?
So I graduated from college in 95.
Uh-huh.
So there had been a big reduction in the number of pilots that we were producing them. But I was selected and then able to go to Shepherd Air Force Base, which was the home of the Euro-NATO Joint Jet Pilot Training Program. So a bunch of NATO countries, including the US, go train there together. And the idea was that you train there together. Most of the people that trained there would go to fighters eventually. And then you would have this career where you had a broad exposure to different cultures and different people and different ways of thinking.
Huh. Pilot training, it's a long process, long road, arduous as well. What were some of the key factors you learned during that you thought that you started bringing forward?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I tell a story about is sort of in learning the way that I learn. And I tend to, if I'm learning something new, I'm a little bit slow picking it up at the very beginning because I'm going like way deep back. I want to find those first principles and really sort of nail those down. And if I can learn those first principles, then I can build up from that and get better at doing it.
Right. It's kind of what we're doing here.
Sure. I'm all in. I'm all in. So I went first to what was called the flight screening program. So it's before they invest a lot of money to make you a pilot, they would send you to go fly for a little while just to see if you had the aptitude to be able to learn fast enough to complete pilot training. This was in Hondo, Texas, so outside of San Antonio.
Right.
And before I went to that program, I had never, maybe I'd had one like pilot training lesson, one of those free lessons that you would get at the airport and you go and you get the first flights free or whatever.
Right.
But this was the first time that I was actually in a training program trying to learn to become a pilot myself. And it was the ride right before solo. So the first time that you're going to go out and fly by yourself, and this was a small like acrobatic plane, a 3 Slingsby Firefly was the name of it, side-by-side propeller trainer. So it's the ride right before solo, and I don't pass, right? I fail that ride. So then I fly with a supervisor on the next sortie. I don't pass that sortie either.
Why aren't you passing?
So honestly, I don't remember exactly what the problem was, thinking back, because it was solo, it had to be around like landing or flying in the pattern, because that's the thing that you're most focused on. But honestly, I don't remember like the exact things that were there. But what I do remember is I finally go to the third time, right? If you fail 3 times in a row, then it's the end of the road, right? You're getting voted off the island and you'll go back to doing something else. So I go and I fly with an instructor. We fly, we're taxiing back towards the ramp, and either we turn left and he gets out of the airplane and I go fly solo and my career continues, or he says, turn right. And we go back to the ramp and we park and it's all over.
Right.
And the whole time taxiing back, like, I don't know what the answer is. Like, I'm not sure what he's going to say. And then we get there, stop. And I do remember like looking over at him and he's looking at me and he says, turn left. He gets out, I go fly. And then 25 years later, here I am talking to you about pilot training and about those things that I did, but it all pivoted on these relatively small moments.
Yeah.
Right. These relatively small moments. And as I continue to understand like how I learn and really how others learn as well, I don't fear that so much, right? I know that if I go back and I look at those first principles and I can start building back from that, ultimately I'm going to be better than if I just sort of did the motions and went through the actions and try to pick something up faster.
So what do we learn from that we brought forward into our next stage of training?
So it is, I mean, it's really that not to be scared of moving slow at the beginning, right? That it's going to pay off, and that focus on those principles, go a little bit deeper and understand how you can create this repeatable success rather than this early, move fast and right. Do quick wins. Sometimes it's okay to dig in and go for that deep knowledge and build that over time.
Nice. So what was next?
So after that flight screening program, I went to Shepherd, and I went there through pilot training, and then I stayed there to teach. So I was it's called a first assignment instructor pilot.
How'd you get assigned A-10s?
So I taught for 3 years in the T-37.
Oh, okay.
So I stayed there after pilot training, and I taught the brand new pilots. So my first assignment as a pilot was to teach other pilots.
Right.
So I did that for 3 years, and I was pretty good at it.
That's and a lot the, of reps.
Yeah, it was about 1,000. I think I had 1,000 hours in the T-37. That's all 1.3 hours.
Right. Yep.
But it was great, right? Because again, it's like all back to those first principles. Because you're teaching people from the basics. Like they show up, maybe they've done a screening program like we did before, but everything that they know about being a military pilot comes from that 6 months that you're with them.
Right.
And I was a pretty good instructor. So at the end, the wing commander said, what do you want to go fly? And I said, well, I think I want to go fly the A-10. And he said, well, we have an F-16, we have an F-15E and an F-15C. Would you like one of those? Like, yeah, I really like the A-10. Like, all right, let me go see what I can trade. So he trades away one of those other airplanes. And then he comes back the next day and says, all right, we got an A-10. You're in.
What made you want to fly the A-10? For those listening that might not know planes so well, give a brief description of what each of those are so they know the difference and the choice you made, because I think that's really impactful that you decided to fly the A-10 and not the whiz-bang F-15.
Yeah. I mean, so the F-15C is all about, it's an air-to-air fighter, right? They were, in fact, their slogan as they were building that airplane was not a pound for air-to-ground. It was all designed to be an air superiority fighter, and it's very good at what it does. And it's all about dogfighting other airplanes. And the people that go do that are incredible at that mission, but that really didn't speak to me. And then there's the F-15E that I mentioned earlier that my uncle was a backseater in. And in fact, when we were considering like what aircraft we would get, there was some video that we were watching from, I forget exactly what operation it was, but there was some operation where the F-15Es were performing and they fired a missile and the missile's in the air and the backseater is like switching the targets on the way, like while the missile's in flight, deciding, oh no, it should be this one. Oh, wait, wait, I was a mistake. It should be this one. And eventually the missile impacts, but I wanted every decision to be mine.
Right
or wrong, it was my decision. And I'm the person who is responsible and accountable for that decision. And a two-seater aircraft, that's not how that operates, right?
Right.
The F-16 is a small single seat. They have some two-seat versions. Single engine sports car of an airplane. It does air to air. It does air to ground. And it's, you can be sort of a jack of all trades in that airplane. But what I wanted to do was do something where I could be, maybe the best in the world at doing that thing. And the thing that the A-10 does, it's a single seat airplane. There are no two seat versions that the Air Force ever bought, but it is, I'll argue with anyone, it is the best in the world at providing close air support.
Right,
for supporting the troops on the ground so that when they are in a fight, the A-10s show up and it'll change your day. It'll turn a good day bad for the enemy and turn a bad day good for the people that you're trying to protect. It's mostly a gun that was designed. And then they said, how can we fly this gun around? They built built an airplane around it. And everybody that's involved in the A-10 mission is motivated to protect the people that are on the ground, that you have this higher purpose for support, and it's incredibly good at what it does.
What was the inspiration to want to support people on the ground?
So the I mean, the people that are on the ground fighting are often, you know, they're going to be younger than me. They're not, you know, sleeping in the nice, you know, Air Force, you know, lodging with the big air conditioners and stuff that we have. And they're out there for a long time doing the hard work. And if I can show up in the A-10, I want people to shoot at me instead of shooting at them. Because if you shoot at me, I'll shoot back. I have a bigger gun than you do. And often, especially like in Afghanistan, just flying overhead and making yourself visible was enough that the enemy would say, today's not the day. We're not going to go and fight those, you know, the Americans or the coalition troops that we're protecting there. And if I can show up and just my presence being there makes life better for them and helps them to sleep better at night, then that's a good life.
It's really, I wish the characteristic was more common in the world of that kind of selfless service of putting yourself in the line of fires for others. And just making that choice, you were doing it. Did any idea who inspired you and modeled that behavior for you?
Well, one, like, I want to say that it's not just me, right? It's every person, certainly in the A-10 community.
Right.
That is why the A-10 community is the way it is, right? That is the mission, and that is exactly what people want to do. And the answers I'm giving you would be the same answers that you would hear from, you know, any of my brothers or sisters that fly the A-10. But
it's way heroes answer, by the way. Keep going.
But you know, if I think about it, it's kind of like the decision to be in the military. Like that's what you are deciding to do, right? That you are doing something that other people either aren't able or aren't willing to do. And it's just it's service to this higher cause. In choosing the aircraft that I was going to fly, I get to be a little bit more precise in the type of service that I was going to do. And what you would find, especially like in Afghanistan was the only place that I flew, you know, the A-10s in combat, but people would come back from the field. They come back to Bagram and they've got the big dining hall and they're tired and they're exhausted,
right?
But they would come back and they would meet up with the A-10 unit there. And you would meet them in the chow hall and you'd have dinner and they'd talk about how you saved their life. Right.
Oh my gosh.
And you were there, you were doing your job and you're doing what you were trained to do and you were proud to do it, but it made a real difference, like a legitimate difference in the lives of the people that you were there to protect.
Wow. Powerful. All right. So what's next?
So I fly the A-10 for a while and then eventually you got to grow up, right? You gotta do something else.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. So like that point came when I was in, it was my second assignment in Germany and weather's tough in Germany. And at the time that I was there, the A-10s were also going through this major upgrade. So there wasn't very much flying to be had. And at the end of 1 year, I was a stand-of-al pilot. So I would give check rides to anyone, right? I'm the one that certifies that, yes, you're still good to fly. You're safe. You're capable. You're good at the mission. And you're good at, you know, flying around. But at the end of 1 year of doing that, I'd only flown like 25 times in the year. And most of those sorties were sorties where I was just giving instrument check rides.
Right.
So no like tactical, I think two tactical training sorties in a year. And you just can't be good at something very difficult if you're not doing it more than that.
Right.
So I said, all right, I need to do something different. So if you remember, I mentioned earlier that when I went to college, I was doing computer science, but I was really maybe more interested in international relations.
Right.
So I had the opportunity to get a master's degree in international relations while I was there. And I applied to be a military attaché.
Oh, right, wow.
Working in foreign embassies and doing, you know, representing the US military to those governments. So I remember like filling out my application. I had the support of my, you know, the two-star that I was working for at the time. And I picked several places in Eastern Europe. And a couple months later, they came back and said, all those places you picked, you're not getting any of those. But
hey, what was your rank at the time too? I apologize for
it. No, I was a major then.
Okay.
Yeah. So they came back and said, all those places you picked, you're not getting any of those, but you can either be the assistant air attaché in South Africa, or you can be the defense attaché in Kyrgyzstan. I was like, well, I'd love to learn to speak Russian. So if I'm going to be somewhere, I'd prefer to be the person in charge rather than the assistant to somebody who's not in charge.
All right. I got to stop. So yeah. you mentioned this a couple of times. You wanted to be the person in charge. You wanted to fly. You didn't want to be in a two-seater where someone else might make a decision. Any idea where that desire to be in command came from?
Yeah. No, thanks for it's interesting to be on this side of this type of interview. When I'm writing stories for other people, I'm sort of trying to make those connections and do that.
What was the first time? How about that? When was the first time you recognized that you had a desire to lead?
So truthfully, it's probably in ROTC.
Okay.
Right. So my sophomore year there, we had a commander who came in who actually was an F-15C pilot. Uh-huh. And he was the leader of that detachment. He was a lieutenant colonel who came in charge. And I think he was the one that really like started teaching us about leadership and about what it means to be you're technically skilled in the career that you're doing, but also a leader where it doesn't depend on your technical skills, that leadership itself is a skill. And I think he's probably the one who inspired that. And when I pinned on Colonel many years later, he came back and I asked him to do the ceremony, and he's the one that pinned me on.
Nice. There you go. I was just curious because it was a powerful thread for you. Anyway, keep going.
Yeah. So I decided I wanted to be in charge if I had the option, and I wanted to learn to speak Russian. So it happened to be that we were on a family trip in Scotland, I think at the time.
Family?
And so my wife, my son, who was young, probably less than 3 years old at the time, and then my in-laws were there as well. And we're on the train, and I have this conversation with the Air Force Personnel Command. And I said, all right, let me go talk to my wife. I'll call you back. And I go and I talk to my wife, Heather. Like, so they offered us, we can either go to South Africa or to Kyrgyzstan. I said, I think I'd like to go to Kyrgyzstan. She said, where's Kyrgyzstan? It's in Central Asia, kind of close to China. She's like, if that's what you want to do, I'm in. So I called him back and we got on that path to go there.
And how long has she been a military wife for? Because just saying we're in is, it takes a special person to do that. So good for Heather.
Yeah. So she had only at that point been a military wife for about 4 years.
Wow.
So not very long. We knew each other, all of our life growing up. We lived just a few houses apart, but after high school, we went, separate ways. And then we came back together.
And what was the inspiration to go for Russian?
And so, so I grew up during the Cold War days, right? And I don't know if you remember, but there was that TV show, The Day After, right? Which is about this giant, like, nuclear, Holocaust. And it was a scary movie as a kid at that time. And I remember for months after that, you'd hear planes flying over at night, the kid's imagination, like, maybe that's it. Maybe that's the missiles that are coming. And in fact, as kids, we even like had this whole plan for like how we would invade the Soviet Union and take over the place as like fifth grade.
Red Dawn, grade kids. The original.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. So there was always like this fascination with that time and that experience.
Right.
And I was pretty good at languages as well. And Russian's not an easy one. It's not as hard as Chinese.
How did you discover you're good at languages? Because you're like, you're sowing these threads of this Renaissance man who just kind of blossom where you're touching. How'd that happen?
Well, in high school, I took, I took Spanish and I took, French for a couple of years, and even, Latin for a little bit. And then in college, I took French, and just kind of came together.
Nice. All right. So here we are. We're heading to Kyrgyzstan.
Yeah. So to get there though, it was a bit of effort. So we spent a year and a half preparing for that assignment. So 1 year just of language training.
Right.
And it's all one-on-one, just you and a contractor in a small room. Every question that he asks, he's asking me. There's no place to hide. And then at the end of that, I was able to go and spend a month living with a Russian speaking family in Ukraine.
Oh, wow.
So they lived just outside of Kyiv, and that was a great experience in learning like real life Russian. So like in my classes, I could learn to talk about, political topics or nuclear disarmament, but I couldn't tell, for instance, the woman of the house, the grandmother there, that I was full. Like, please don't bring me any more food. I have plenty. Like, stop bringing it. So I had the opportunity to speak to people and learn those more practical things. But the other thing I did was we did this field trip out to the last nuclear base that was in Ukraine, right? At the end of the Cold War, the Ukrainians gave up their nukes, and the guy who was the last commander of that nuclear base, like, stayed there and lived there and opened it up as a museum.
Huh.
So we drove out there and were able to go, and you know, he'd take us around and show us the stuff in this old base, which is pretty much everything was there except for the missiles. And you know, he would tell us, you know, you can sit in this, you know, the control seat for these missiles, and you can do this. And he said, I don't mean to offend anyone, but you know, our targets were places like, you know, Houston and Dallas and these American cities. Like, this was the day after, but it was like years later, and I'm in the place where they were, you know, training to do that. By the end of the trip, they were back in the officers' quarters, because I was one of the few officers that was there, and I'm drinking, you know, shots of vodka and eating pickles, you know, talking to the commander of the person who was tasked to be that side of, you know, the nuclear war if the time came. And for me, in that moment, that was this like incredible turn of events and opportunities that had opened up to me for the way that, you know, that life changes and there's learning that can happen everywhere.
What do you think was the most profound thing you took from that training experience before you went to Kyrgyzstan?
So it was standing there with that commander, where we had, you know, in my lifetime, we had gone from the place where we were avowed enemies, ready to just completely destroy the world to defend, you know, each of our own, you know, ideologies, to now where I'm speaking Russian, we're toasting, we're eating pickles, we're laughing together. And it was a time when, you know, certainly politics had been transcended, and it was just this like humanity.
Right.
Like, humans speak different languages, they have different experiences, but we're not too different.
What did you have in common?
So, I mean, first, we were both in the military. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I ended up doing a lot of work with Russians as well, you know, later in my career. And there is this bond between people who have devoted their life to service of their country.
Right.
Even though the countries can vigorously disagree and maybe be openly hostile to one another, there's still this underlying respect that exists between, you know, between militaries, between people that are dedicated to doing that. And there's just this common understanding that transcends often language and culture and these other things to give you this place to build from.
Right. That's great. All right. So what's next? We're done with our language training, our immersion in Ukraine.
Yeah. So then we spend 6 months at the Defense Intelligence Agency, is where all the training for attachés happens. And then we do some, you know, cool stuff afterwards, some defensive driving, off-road driving. And Heather's able to go to all that as well. And she's, if your driver gets shot, she's the person you want in the passengers. Yeah. She's good at doing that. She's also a pretty good shot herself as well.
Was she all in with all this?
Oh, she loved it. Yeah, it was fantastic.
Was she learning Russian also?
Yes. Yeah. She did.
Wow.
Yeah. She had her own teacher. They offered us the chance to be in the same class. But as I mentioned, we had grown up together.
Right.
And she knew how I was in class, and she knew how she was in class. And if we wanted to stay married, we shouldn't put ourselves back in the same class again.
Great self-awareness. Anyway, keep going.
Yeah. So we finished that, and then we go to Kyrgyzstan for 2 years. So it is, I mean, it's a relatively poor, you know, poor country in a tough place in Central Asia, but there's this interesting combination of cultures in Central Asia, right? That you have the Kyrgyz like to say that their cities were never conquered by Genghis Khan because they didn't have any cities. They were nomadic people. Right. They lived up in the mountains. So you have this ancient like nomadic culture that's there, and then Islam comes, and then they have, you know, this persistent, you know, Chinese influence. The Soviets, you know, took over the place for 70 years. And then at the time that I was there was an American base there as well, Manas Air Base, that we were using as a refueling base to support operations in Afghanistan. So you had this really interesting, you know, cross-cultural experience all happening in Central Asia. And it was remarkable just to meet people there and to learn how, you know, these different like amalgamation of cultures, you know, functions and works, and just to understand people better.
What was your greatest challenge in that assignment?
So, I mean, practically, it was doing it in Russian, right? So you would, you know, you go, you meet people, you talk to people, you know, I'm doing it in Russian. And then I would need to like remember, you know, like what we talked about, right? And be able to, you know, to preserve those memories. And it's a challenge, right? Like, I'm naturally an introverted person. I do my thinking on the inside. I can be extroverted when I need to be, but being extroverted and doing it in a different language at the same time can be exhausting. So you got to like lean into it and make it work.
Yeah, no doubt. So what was next after that?
So from there, I go back to the Pentagon and I was working like international fighter training programs, mostly working on the Afghan A-29 program, which is another small turboprop type aircraft and a little bit of work.
Lieutenant colonel yet or a colonel?
Yep, I was a lieutenant colonel by that time. Okay. But primarily the function I had was helping to bring the A-29 to Afghanistan, to the Afghan Air Force. And during that time, I also went back to Afghanistan, this time as an air advisor, working there, helping to implement that program. But interestingly, when I was there, the Afghan air chief, his English was not very good, but his Russian was still exceptional. He spent a lot of time training with the Russians when they were there, you know, previously. And we could have, you know, conversations in Russian that we couldn't have in English. And I was even able to bring him back to the US when we were releasing one of those, the first airplane, right, you know, to the Afghans. I brought him back here and translated for him when we were back in the US. It was just a really weird, you know, twist of fate in history that, you know, put us sort of in the same place at the same time.
Yeah, no kidding. All right. So what's next?
So I get back from that deployment. I was deployed only for about 7 months. So I come back and I take maybe a couple of weeks off, you know, spending some leave or whatever before I go back to my desk. And I'm walking in to the Pentagon and I literally still have the box of my stuff in my hands as I'm walking in to move back into my desk. I have not put the box down. And my supervisor, my call sign was Beef. He's like, "Hey, Beef, we just got a note saying that you're..."
That's a great call sign.
So he's like, "Hey, Beef, we just got a note saying you're hot for another deployment." I'm like, "How can I be hot for another deployment? I am literally holding the box of my stuff in my hands." I'm like, "Well, you didn't stay there long enough for it to count as a short tour, so you're still on the top of the short tour list." I'm like, "All right, let me see what I can do." So I applied like that day or the next day to be a speechwriter for the chief of staff of the Air Force or the undersecretary of the Air Force.
Right.
And I got hired for that job, and nobody was going to tell. Eventually it was the speechwriter for the undersecretary, and nobody was going to tell the undersecretary that the speechwriter that she had just chosen needed to go do this job that anybody else could do. So I was able to do that speechwrite for her. And then when I did get promoted, then I went on a 1 year remote tour then.
So speechwriters are really, really highly skilled, coveted communicators. It takes a special person, and more importantly, to be recognized by others. Why do you think they saw in you that they chose you for that?
I'm a pretty good writer, right? So like in the initial things that we had to write for them to review, that was enough to get an interview. And then you're a better judge than I am right now, but I'm pretty good at putting words together, right? At communicating some idea in a way that other people can understand. And if you can do those things and you have the ability to think at the level that an undersecretary is thinking and help her to effectively communicate and formulate her message, it's it could be a real value add.
You went to college for cyber, and yet you are this phenomenal communicator. Where did you learn? Where was the crossover?
So, like one of the, I've won or earned whatever, a variety of different awards through my life. But the one that I'm probably the most proud of was the top English student as a senior in high school, because my teacher was fantastic. She was known, Ms. Roby was her name. Uh-huh. And she was known as like the hardest teacher in maybe in the whole county, but certainly at that school. She had high expectations for her students, and you wanted to meet her expectations. And at the end of that year, they have the little, you know, school award ceremony or whatever. And I won like her award for saying that I was pretty good at doing English. So when I think back on all the things that I've done, like that is one of the awards that I'm most proud of having won. And I, as I mentioned, I did computer science because that's what paid for me to go to college.
Right.
So eventually had this opportunity to take sort of those skills from before and put them in, you know, in practice in the Air Force and do something completely different.
I'm just smiling because I discovered the anchoring thread. I was curious what it was.
Yeah.
It was our high school English teacher that gave us an award that that came to blossom later on as a speechwriter for the undersecretary. That's remarkable.
Yeah. So teachers are amazing.
Yeah. With the right encouragement, they send us down a path that becomes our lives. It's truly inspirational. All right. So we're the speechwriter. What do we do with that? So now we're in full-time storytelling mode.
Yeah. So I'm pretty good at doing speech writing. So I get selected for promotion.
So how do you define I was pretty good at speech writing? How is that measured?
So it's measured by your principal, right? So she continued to ask me to write speeches for her.
Okay.
So if you're delivering a product that your principal thinks communicates their ideas and is helpful to them and they're using your speech, then you're doing the work.
I'm seeing the seeds for working with people creating stories. No doubt this was it.
Yeah. I mean, yes. I mean, like the stories that I create, I create them in the voice of the person whose story it is, right? So I'm a tool to help them to communicate their story, and being a speechwriter, really focusing on how do I communicate ideas that are not necessarily my own ideas, or maybe they're ideas that I can internalize, but how do I communicate those ideas in someone else's voice? Like that's the real, like the hardest part of helping people to write their stories.
Yeah. How many did you do?
Speeches?
Yeah.
During that year, I don't know, maybe I probably did 15 or 16, you know, for her. And then I did, you know, sorted maybe four or five for like one for the secretary and some for the assistant, you know, the vice chiefs of staff or whatever for the Air Force as well.
How do you create a story that's not yours? I mean, that's I never even thought about that till you brought that up. How do you do that?
So, I mean, a big part of it is like exactly what's happening now, except I'm on the other side. Right? It's asking questions, making connections, and helping to sort of pull out those pieces that you need to be able to write. And then it's listening attentively, right? Listening to the types of words that people use. Maybe there's a key phrase that they would keep going back to, or maybe there's, you know, a little bit of slang or jargon, or like now sometimes I'll write for people who are British, right? And it's a different style of speech. It's more formal, but if I want to write something that they can deliver, I've got to write in that style for them. Or at the same time, I'll write for maybe a military veteran who is, you know, younger than me and is, you know, has a different approach to life and the way that they are talking about their things. You've got to be able to serve both of them by sort of, you know, splitting your brain into the part that you need to deliver.
I'm really curious. You seem, and you definitely come across as extremely passionate and into being a pilot and supporting troops on the ground as an A-10 pilot. And then equally just as skilled, passionate about creating stories for people. Are they connected in any way?
So, I mean, there's the obvious connection is in the fighter pilots tell stories.
There you go.
And as an instructor, one of the things that we would say is that you'll never live long enough to make all the mistakes yourself. You have to learn from the mistakes of others. And the way that you learn from the mistakes of others is through storytelling.
Okay.
So even as I was, you know, teaching, you know, new pilots, a lot of that is storytelling. As I was teaching people in the A-10, a lot of that is storytelling. And on Friday nights in the bar, I would be the MC for the events, which are, you know, it's not all, you know, debauchery that's going on there. Like there's like legitimately like this purpose of bringing people together, and whether you drank or you didn't drink, it honestly didn't matter. And there were people who would opt for either of those things, but it was coming together to build that camaraderie and to share lessons and ideas. And if you could find a way to make it entertaining at the same time and people liked doing it, then it was good. It was a good place to be.
You had all so it was a lifetime of reps of learning how to tell stories inspired by your high school teacher.
Yeah.
With all these what's and hows were fueling the why in your life. So, all right. So yeah, we're starting to really flower and blossom in our skill set of being a storyteller, and more importantly, helping other people tell their stories. What was next?
Yeah. So I get selected for promotion while I was in that job, and the under calls me into her office and is like, Beef, congratulations, you got promoted.
Sorry, and, keep laughing. I love Beef.
Keep going, Beef.
And you know, she said, you know, the 4-star, you know, really wants you to go to Sumter, South Carolina, to Shaw Air Force Base. And he's got this idea that he's working on. He really wants you to go there and be one of the people in charge of turning this idea into reality. But it's really got to be something you want to do because it's a hard job. And I said, you know what, ma'am? The needs of the Air Force and family Beef do not intersect in Sumter, South Carolina. That's just not something I'm interested in doing. I said, but this was just a couple months after the Russians had moved into Syria, right? So we're fighting ISIS down there. The Russians, you know, set up a base down there. I said, I guarantee that there are no Russian-speaking fighter pilots at the Combined Air Operations Center right now. And that's a one-year remote tour away from your family. I was like, if I could do that assignment and somehow, you know, bring value using this very unique skill set that I have, bring value to that organization, like that'd be something that I would stay into the Air Force and accept a promotion to be able to do. 2 or 3 days later, I got a call saying, hey, you just got selected to be the deputy commander at the CAOC. Yeah, sometimes things work.
Oh, that's remarkable. So tell me about that experience.
So really my job as the deputy commander there was running sort of the day-to-day air operations in the fight against ISIS.
Wow.
So it's the actual execution of how we're going to do the air operations. In doing that, I also ran the hotline between the U.S. headquarters at the CAOC, the Combined Air Operations Center in Qatar, and the Russian headquarters in Syria. So in the beginning, we would have calls. I think we did them 3 times a week with the Russians. So we call them up, making sure the hotline still works. Do you have anything? No. Do you have anything? No. By the end, we were talking like 20 times a day about, as our forces continued to get closer and closer together, the deconfliction that was required to make sure that we weren't attacking each other's forces, that we weren't sparking some, you know, larger, you know, war or fight that we didn't intend to do, that was a full-time job, you know, working that part of the operation. And then separately, I was also a target engagement authority. So I would approve strikes against ISIS targets, not the ones that were where there were friendly forces, ones that were much further back, where there were, you know, civilians, obviously, but in territory that ISIS controlled. And during that time, I think I approved something like 768 targets while I was there.
What did you bring from your experience as a storyteller, speechwriter that helped you in this job?
So I don't know if it's so much even the storytelling part, other than, like, as I would talk with the Russians,
communication skills.
That's exactly what I was going to, right? That as I would talk with the Russians, it was important to be like, to be clear and to be trusted. Right. Now we get to the forge by trust, you know, part of the,
I'm just thinking about podcast, you as a speechwriter, and that's exactly what you were doing. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So as I would talk to the Russians, you know, I was a Russian speaker, but we also had very capable interpreters there, because I was pretty good, but I need other people there to help me. Right. So I go from this place where I believed that I was, you know, wanted to be alone, like making all the decisions myself and flying the A-10 and sort of valuing that, to this place where I start to learn that I do my best thinking when I think with other people, that when I have other people that are there to help me, who are, you know, native speakers, and they can help me to translate and help me. I would talk to them beforehand, like, here's the message I want to deliver. So they're not having to make it up on the spot. We can have this conversation. Like, here's what I intend. Like, what are you going to tell them? And they would tell me, and then I would say, oh, I thought that word meant more of this thing. Like, no, it's really more of this. Like, perfect. So by the time we get on the phone, now I can be sure that the message that I intend to convey is the one that's being conveyed. And then when they would talk back to us, you know, I could understand, you know, 95% of the message that they were intending, but these native speakers could help me understand like what they weren't saying, right? Like, those are the words that they use, but here's like the underlying intent that they intended through that thing. And it was a really interesting time to start working together with other people in this high consequence work where you needed the thoughts and the input of people from different specialties and different pieces of expertise to be able to make smart decisions and save lives.
Holy cow, you were born to do that. At that time and place.
I was fortunate,
Yeah. I mean, thank goodness it was you. I mean, jeez, that's just tremendous. All right, so Dan, what's next?
Well, I mean, so the other thing that is important that happened here was in approving those strikes, right? I mean, 768 was a lot. And I was the first colonel to be doing it. Like before me, it was always general officers were the only ones that were able to to give that approval. But as the strikes started becoming more, they were able to, and the tolerance for, I mean, truthfully, the tolerance for getting it wrong was bigger, not my personal tolerance, but the institutional tolerance. So they let someone who wasn't a general officer start approving strikes.
So they gave you an awful lot of authority to do that when no one else had that before. What were they seeing in you that you made them feel safe with the decisions you were making? Well, why?
I mean, it's tough, right? It's a tough thing for me to see, from my side. But I think deeply about things, right? So sort of those first principles, right? So the questions that I ask go back to understanding those first principles. And if I understand those, now we can build something from that. And they would see that in my conversations with the Russians. Right. I was for a long time, I was the Russian expert in CENTCOM. Right, CENTCOM focuses on the Middle East. There were no Russian experts in the entire CENTCOM. So even General Votel, I would talk to him sometimes about here's the way the Russians think about these things, and they say these things, but here's these other things that we have to be thinking about when we're making these types of decisions. So I was having conversations that were well above my pay grade, but they fell into the expertise that I was able, and I was the only one able to offer for a long part of that time. So when it came time to start making someone else, a target engagement authority, I was already there, in the battle cab doing the work. All right, Beef, here, let's talk about how you do this.
Yeah, and then you made them feel safe with the decisions you were making.
Yeah, yeah.
What was next?
This is an important part in literally the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Because what I started to understand there was more about these cognitive biases that we all hold.
Right.
These illusions that we create. And some of them are easier to see. Like quickly the language moves away from talking about people that you're about to approve a strike on to kill. And you start using other words to talk about people, right? Even I called them targets just a few minutes ago, right? Or you'll talk about adult males, or you start using these other words that sort of create this psychological distance between the work that you are actually doing and the choices you're making, right?
Right.
And even in target approval briefs for pre-planned targets, the intel person will brief, this is a suspected ISIS car bomb, car bomb factory. We've been observing it for this long. We've seen this type of activity. But then the next time they say it, they don't say a suspected ISIS car bomb factory. They say this ISIS car bomb factory has been, or we've seen adult males operating around this ISIS car bomb factory, and they start changing the speech. So by the end of the presentation, it's like, well, sir, do you want to blow up this ISIS car bomb factory? Which sort of removes all of that doubt and that speculation that should have still been attached to that decision by the time it got there. And it would take an incredible amount of discipline from the organization to not be overcome by those biases.
Yeah. Right.
Especially as the pressure to attack more. I was there as the administration changed, the strategy became more aggressive against ISIS. And that's a choice that the democratically elected administration chooses to make. And it's our job to execute that guidance aggressively. But as there's this increased pressure to attack, and you have these cognitive biases coming together, it was incredibly easy for people to make decisions that weren't maybe based in logic anymore, or weren't rational choices, because we as humans get sort of overcome by these illusions and we make our decisions based on quick answers, even well-meaning people, right? That we go for what's quick rather than the harder, messier answers that maybe are a little bit more difficult to get to, but are probably the right answers in those situations.
What do you do to offset that, those biases? That's incredible.
So, I mean, one is like being aware of it, right, is the first thing. Like knowing that that is the thing that happens, that you have this underlying current of bad things happen. Two is you need good leadership. And we had tremendous leadership there at the time. And sort of their approach was, for the strikes that we were doing, they're like, no single strike that you will ever approve will win this war. But you could approve a strike that will set us way back. If you strike the wrong place, or if you end up, you know, killing lots of innocent civilians, it could really hamper the war effort. So when in doubt, like, don't strike. At the same time, you know, we're fighting a war, right? We are, we need to degrade it, because if we can attack ISIS targets that are far back from the front lines, they never make it to the front lines, right? If we can destroy their ability to sustain their war effort, then the war effort will not take as long. So you're still having to balance these two things. But then the last thing is, we think better when we think with other people.
Right.
So like legitimately working to make sure that you could get a variety of other opinions. And the two-star that helped, you know, train me in doing this, you know, I would watch briefs as he would get them. The targeting people would come up and they would have the big map laid out. They have all their intel pictures and they're talking to him about the target. And he would listen to them. He would ask questions. And at the end of the brief, before he gave his decision, he would ask every person around the table, even if they were just guests who would come by and happen to be listening to the brief, do you have any questions or anything else we should be thinking about? Any doubts, any reservations? And he was legitimate about that question.
Right.
And gave everybody the chance, maybe even more than the chance, the obligation to speak up if you think this isn't right. And only then would he make his decision about, all right, we're going to strike it. And here's the restrictions that I'm going to put on that strike.
Dan, I got a question, and you don't have to answer it if you're not comfortable.
Yeah.
I'm curious. That's a huge weight that must have been on you mentally for what you're doing. How did you and the people you work with maintain a sense of mental stability during that? I mean, that sounds really challenging.
So I'm not sure we did, right? Because what you do and what I've discovered.
I mean, these are some traumatic decisions you're making.
I was in therapy for years afterwards, right? But what you do, like when you're in, I mean, you know this, I think probably from your own experience, like when you're in the situation, you have to put up this barrier between you and your, like you can't think too much about the thing that you're doing, right? It kind of sounds like contrary to what I was just saying, but you have to like leave that shield up, right? You have to leave that hard shell so that you can make those decisions that you know are the decisions that have to be made, and put off dealing with them until later. And the trick here is that you eventually have to deal with them.
Right.
If you don't deal with them, they will destroy you. Like legitimately, they will kill you. And that's, you see this, you know, a rash of veteran suicides, right? And it's because people, in many cases, like don't deal with it. You can put it off for a while. It's the thing that you have to do to survive. But then you've got to reckon with them. You got to come back and put those things together, and then integrate those into the person that you want to become.
All right. So that was profound. Are we ready to move on from there to what was next?
Sure. So from there, I go back to the Pentagon. And in fact, when I went back to the Pentagon, the expectation was that I would go back for just a few months and then would go be an attaché in Moscow. But I wasn't done with my therapy, right? I wasn't done with taking care of all that other stuff. And so I made the decision, you know, if I can't go take that assignment, then it's time for me to go. It's time for me to retire and go do something else. So I finished up my work there, and Heather and I decided we'd move back to Alabama. We both knew that we were going to start, you know, businesses ourselves, our families back here. We could come back, and the cost of living is a lot less than it is in the DC area as well. So we're able to take some risks that we couldn't take if we were still living in that area. So we came back, we bought some land, and now we have some land. We're close to our families. We have this building here that we run our businesses out of. And it's a completely new chapter in our lives and what we're doing.
You say completely new chapter.
Well, it's in the same book at least.
You've taken this amazing skill set. So tell me what you do.
Yeah. So most of what I'm doing now is helping people to to tell stories, right? Stories that are about real life, stories that are designed to get ideas from my brain into your brain. So I'm not writing fiction. I'm not, you know, telling stories for, you know, for a moth, you know, podcast or a moth competition or whatever, which is a lot of fun as well. I'm trying to help mostly founders, coaches, and consultants to tell stories that get those ideas across, but at the same time, ensure that they're heard, understood, and trusted.
What are some of the challenges people have that you help them overcome in that?
So the first is people, especially founders, coaches, and consultants, are very solution focused. Like they know what the end is, but the people that they're trying to persuade are problem focused. Specifically, they're focused on the symptoms of the problem that they have. They may not even be experts on what the real problem is, but they know where it hurts. And you've got to have, if you're telling a story, when you're trying to persuade that person, you have to speak in the language of that customer, where you've got to talk about those symptoms that they're feeling. And you build that into a story the way that humans have transferred information for 100,000 years. You build it into the way that humans expect a story to show up. And when you do that, it communicates. And there's tons of research that shows that as you do that, you also get this release of oxytocin in your audience. And that starts to build trust in them. So not only do they understand what you're saying, they hear sort of your approach, but they believe, you know, that's the kind of person I can trust to help me take care of this problem.
So we build trust through storytelling, which I love.
Yeah.
Another turn of words you had, applied creativity.
Yeah. So most of the time when people think about creativity, they think about like artistic ability, right? They think about maybe dance or painting or sculpture or something else. And those are fantastic ways of demonstrating your creativity. But the creativity that I did in my career was focused on solving problems. Like how can I think better than either my adversary or the problems to be able to come up with a good solution? So one of the things that I talk about is the, you know, ISIS developed these small drones. Right. Well, they bought the drones and then they rewired them so they could drop grenades off of them. That was a creative act, right? That was taking something from one context, turning it into a weapon, and they were effective at making life difficult for us. But when people think about creativity, they're not thinking about that, right? They're thinking about painting pictures. So applied creativity is how can we use those same skills that you would use in artistic creativity, for instance, apply them to problems to come up with solutions that work, right? That help us to eliminate these nagging problems that we've had, or even new problems that our old solutions just don't work for.
And so just so people have like one or two ideas on how storytelling can solve problems in their lives, what are a couple examples of, all right, here's how a great storytelling capability could actually solve this problem in your life, either personal or professional, you think?
Yeah, I mean, so like the most direct problems are things where you struggle to be heard and understood.
Ah, yeah.
So I worked with one founder, one of the very first, you know, stories for hire that I was doing. And I had talked to him for several hours, but I didn't understand his business. Like he wasn't very good at communicating what it was that he was doing. And then he took one of my workshops and he said, "Hey, can I just hire you to help me write a story?" I'm like, "All right, yeah, let's do that." So I spent an hour interviewing him and asking him the questions that I needed to build the story. And by the end, he had a great idea that was just hidden under all this, this clutter that he couldn't actually, you know, pull apart. So I wrote a story for him. He, you know, sends me a text that week later and says, "I delivered that story for the first time. Not only did they understand me, they gave me my biggest check ever." Boom. All right. It works.
And there you go. Dan, what are one or two things, if any, that I forgot to ask you that you wanted to make sure you shared with everyone before we get going?
So like probably the most important part of writing a story and something I talk about in the storytelling course that I do, is that every story worth telling and every story worth hearing is a story of transformation. It's always a story of change. And if you center your story around that change, it's going to be more effective. And even in our conversation today, I've probably talked about, I don't know, maybe 15 or 20 different moments of change. And each one of those moments of change separates the way things used to be from the way they are now. So you can use those stories to guide other people in helping them to make those choices. You can hear other people's stories to give you more information because you won't live long enough to make all the mistakes yourself. But you can also aim for those places where you create those moments of transformation in your own life, where you find those places to look for the opportunity to transform yourself into the person you want to be. And if you string enough of those together, then you're doing something.
Dan, where can people go to find out more about you and bring you into their lives?
Yeah, go to, so always follow me on LinkedIn. I post a ton of content there and I'm engaged with people there. Also, you can check me out at buildthestory.com and it sort of has all of our services and you can see, you know, my LinkedIn content there as well. And I guarantee you'll get something that'll make you a better storyteller.
Absolutely. And it's all in the show notes as always. Dan, I can't thank you enough for sharing your profound story and the tremendous service you've been to our country and our NATO allies and the world in general. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing.
Well, thanks for asking great questions. I really appreciate the opportunity.
You betcha, Dan. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Forged by Trust. Remember, if you want to forge trust, it's not how you make people feel about you that matters. It's how you make them feel about themselves. If you're interested in more information about how I can help you forge your own trust building, communication, and interpersonal strategies as a speaker, your coach, or as a trust advisor for you or your organization, please visit my website at www.peopleformula.com. I'm looking forward to sharing my next Forged by Trust episode with you next week when we do a deep dive into naked leadership with Adrian Kohler.